I turn the page over.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I am a blank page.
Bring together words and music, and you make art. And if you're composer Stephen Sondheim, or hip-hop poet MK Asante, well, then you make magic. Today, we're talking with artists who tangle music and words together, composers and performers from the worlds of hip-hop, jazz, and musical theater. Also, a pioneering neuroscientist looks inside the brains of freestyle rappers.
When somebody gets into this kind of zone where the rhymes are flowing, if you think about it from a brain perspective, it's phenomenal.
When you think about hip-hop, what comes to mind first, the words or the beat? It's a chicken and egg question, isn't it? In great hip-hop, lyrics and music, words and beat are inseparable. Writer and filmmaker MK Asante's new memoir chronicles some rough years as a teenager growing up on the streets of Philadelphia. Today, at age 31, he's a tenured professor and an award-winning poet and filmmaker. And his new book is filled with the rhythms and beats of hip-hop. It's called Buck.
Young buck, buck wild, buck shots, buck town, black buck, make buck, slay buck, buck now.
So your book is dedicated to all the young bucks, and there's so many meanings for that term. I know that's a really loaded term for you. Can you kind of deconstruct it a bit?
I mean, definitely, you know, for me, it's like I chose Buck for all those different reasons. You know, in Philly, you know, we call each other Young Buck. So what's up, Young Buck? Also, to make a buck, you know, to learn about money and the economy, to go buck wild, you know.
To
buck the system. I mean, that's what the book ultimately, I think, that's one of the largest messages for the youth, to not fall into the traps and be stereotypes and statistics, but to buck all of that. And also, I think, you know, when you talk about buck, you know, there's a racial history there. You know, it was a derogatory term for black men during slavery, you know, selling this big black buck over here. So it has those connotations as well.
In the very first pages, we meet one of the most important figures in your life, your brother Uzi, your older brother, who you adored before things went very wrong in his life. And we meet him on the very first page. And I should have asked, I don't know if you brought your book, but or maybe you have this by heart, but I was going to ask you to read a bit from the very beginning.
Definitely, definitely, definitely. Let me read something from this. I'll introduce you to my brother.
Okay.
Me and my big brother Uzi in the kitchen. He's rolling a blunt on top of the source. The one with Tyson on the cover, rocking a koofy, ice grilling through the gloss. Uzi can roll a blunt with his eyes closed. Uzi is the color of walnuts and has a long, sharp face like the African mask my dad hangs up everywhere. His name is Dau. My parents call him Daudi, and the hood calls him Uzi. He's got a bunch of other names, too, like some superhero. Oo-wop, Da-oo, Uzito, Wop the Culture, Cool D, Pinch P, Big Oo, Barker Lark, Drop the Miss Rhyme, Big Fly, and Stilt the Kilt. That's an introduction to my brother Uzi.
MK, when you talk and when you write, you can hear the rhythms and music of hip-hop in your writing. And in fact, hip-hop really is the musical thread that you kind of use to weave the whole story of your life together. Is that just how you happen to write, or is that a really conscious kind of literary decision?
I mean, hip-hop, you know, KRS-One used to say, you know, you're not doing hip-hop, you are hip-hop. You know what I mean? So it's not even something that I can say that it's, I mean, I'm obviously conscious, you know, as a writer of my craft, but at the same time, imbuing hip-hop is just natural for me. In the book, you know, there's hip-hop lyrics that are spread throughout. And the way I describe it very early on in the first few pages of the book. I say, I do this. Spit lyrics to songs under my breath all day, every day. The bars just jump out of me no matter where I am or what I'm doing. It's like hip-hop Tourette's. And that's basically what it is. In fact, yesterday I was having a drink with my friend, and I said a lyric under my breath, and he said, "What'd you say, man?" I said, "No, it's just my hip-hop Tourette's."
And I think that's so familiar, you know, for anybody who has a teenage son, you know, white or black, they all have.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah. So let's go back to your personal story. You know, your beloved older brother, we meet him in the first pages, and also in the first pages, everything goes wrong. I mean, what happens?
Yeah, well, you know, one of his friends comes over and basically has a stolen car. In Philly, we call it a Johnny. So he has a Johnny, and he's like, let's go. And, of course, my brother, about 17 at the time, is like, let's go. They both think it's a good idea. And they end up getting arrested. They end up coming back to the house. The cops raid the house. 20 cops come in, bust down the door. And this is, like, really the beginning of the end in a lot of ways. Things really changed after that with my brother being incarcerated, which sent my mom down a really dangerous road of, you know, attempted suicide and dealing with serious depression.
And school just did not work for you. You write that you didn't read books at all for a long time. And then there was, I mean, clearly you're a writer. Now, all that changed.
Make a long story short, my mom, you know, she kind of begged me to go to school, go back to school. And so there was a school that kind of was for alternative school and take kids in that got kicked out of other places. And it was there that a teacher gave me a blank piece of paper and told me to write. At this point, I had been to some of the worst schools in Philly. I wasn't used to doing schoolwork. And so I said, well, what do you want me to write? And she said, write anything you want. And I said, yeah, well, I know that trick. So I wrote something, I wrote an expletive, and she said, all right, keep going.
It's a blank page down in front of me, pen on top of it like a paperweight. The blank page is the starter pistol that fires and triggers my mind to sprint. I feel something I've never felt before, purpose. A blank sheet of paper saved my life. Everybody in this world has a story.
MK, when you talk about falling in love with that blank page, in some ways it seems to me that it is not so unexpected, you know, because yours is the generation that grew up steeped in poetry, in the rhymes and rhythms of hip-hop.
It's true. No, it definitely, it was really an accessible entry into poetry for a lot of youth. A lot of youth are very familiar with poetic forms and poetic styles, and they don't even know it. They know hip-hop, but they don't understand that because of their understanding of hip-hop, it means that they understand, you know, things about verse form and composition of poetry and structure. So,
internal rhyme schemes, complicated beats and rhythms.
Definitely, definitely. And so the book is about education. It's about miseducation, re-education, street education, self-education. It's about the distance between school and education. But this book is also about finding your own voice. And that was really important to me.
Guys in the hood, trapped in facades in the hood. Always getting even, because what's the odds in the hood? So we mob, so misunderstood, we overstand. City of applause, clapping like Pakistan.
You recently debuted as a rapper in God's in the Hood, an album from Ras Kass. That's just such a great set of lyrics and so complicated. There's so many references in there. Ellison, I mean, literary references, political references. What were you thinking as you were writing that?
You know, when I write, I just let it go. I remove the filter. That's part of the blank page experience, is removing that filter and letting... You know, I'm not always conscious of, okay, well, what am I going to say here? Once I kind of open up, it just kind of flows. And I talk about these guys who are in this cult in my neighborhood who were, you know, called themselves Elohims. And then they went to J Street, which is the open air drug market, and became zombied out, right? And so I say, you know, my Elohims off that wet in them Badlands, you know, the wet, that's, you know, that's what they smoke, right? That's formaldehyde and embalming fluid, right? That's what they smoke in the hood. So, you know, my Elohims off that wet through them Badlands, you know, we're talking about, like you said, Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, that book changed my life. Smoke a L with Ellison, now we visible. Prison and Dust, turning gods to criminals. What I saw happen to my brother in the prison industrial complex.
Self-medicating, I'm writing my own prescription. Self-preservation, I diagnose my condition. Conflicted by these visions, I'm living with my addiction. Convicted by religion, this planet.
Where do you think hip-hop is heading?
I think hip-hop is entering a renaissance period right now. You know, everything is coming back. You know, snapback hats came back, high-top haircuts came back, Arsenio is back. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, everything is cyclical. And one of the things that's coming back in hip hop is substance and lyricism. And I think even, you know, the song that we just heard, God's in the Hood, me being a tenured professor and a writer and a filmmaker, you know, making a hip hop song, you know, with legendary hip hop artists and doing it in that way. To me, that speaks to part of the Renaissance because I feel like I'm a part of it. You know what I mean? I feel like we have to be the change that we want to see. So I feel honored to be in that moment.
MK Asante is a writer, filmmaker, and professor at Morgan State University. He talked with Ann Strange Champs about his memoir, Buck. Is there a science of hip-hop? I mean, imagine if we could peek inside the brain of a hip-hop artist or rapper. What kind of complicated neurological activity would we see? Charles Lim is a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins and a lifelong jazz musician. A few years ago, he put jazz performers inside an fMRI machine and watched their brains light up while they improvised. Now, he's doing the same thing with freestyle rappers. Steve Paulson recently caught up with him.
Charles, why did you want to look inside the brains of rappers?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, as a jazz musician, it was fairly apparent to me early on that even though I was not a rapper, never tried to be a rapper, that when I listened to rap, I could sense that there's something, you know, wildly creative happening. And in many ways, very analogous to what you see in the brain of a jazz musician, I would say. So when I watch freestyle rappers, the thing that is sort of immediately apparent to me is that they enter a different mode of thinking or even a mode of being, so to speak. When somebody gets into this kind of zone where the rhymes are flowing, if you think about it from a brain perspective, it's phenomenal. I mean, the idea that the brain is allowing these individuals to generate so many ideas at such a rapid pace off the cuff, I mean, it's kind of, forgive the pun, it's kind of mind-boggling.
Well, and when you talk about freestyling, I mean, these people are not just reciting lyrics that they memorize. I mean, they're making it up on the spot.
Correct. They don't know what they're going to say. They've never said what they're going to say before, and they'll never say it again. And they get up there, and due to some sort of cue that they're not expecting, they can just launch unexpectedly into this whole new direction.
You got to make sure that you give the people everything that they want. Every single thing is a week. Never explain, I'm never weak. And when I sing and when I speak, I give you so much shit, I'm so deep. I'm an Idaho with just a need. I got to listen to me.
So you brought some professional rappers into your lab, your neuroscience lab. What did they do once they got there?
Mostly rappers from Baltimore and Washington, D.C. I sort of been slowly infiltrating the Baltimore hip-hop underground scene. And so driving around Baltimore with several freestylers in my car, freestyling about whatever they see in front of us, you know, as we drive through Baltimore, has just been, it's eye-opening. It's really astounding what they can do. One of the first freestylers I met was a guy who goes by multiple aliases. The most common one when he's rapping is Slick Vic Low, and he is just a really endlessly fascinating individual, and he lives a life where he is thinking about words and wordplay. He studies rhyming dictionaries, he studies inflection, and he studies the idea of how to rhyme words together that don't rhyme. You know, he studies rap the way I study medicine. I mean, it's just the way it's his calling.
When I die, I leave my soul inside the beat, tattoo my poetry all over my body when you bury me. My illest lyrics written in graffiti and alchemy. Finally, free as an MC, I guarantee heaven won't even be.
Another really interesting fellow is a guy named A-Class, and that's his rapper name. And so A-Class is a fellow who's actually Korean by heritage and was, I believe, adopted by Caucasian parents in Baltimore, but is deeply immersed in African-American hip-hop culture. And so he brings this really kind of interesting pastiche of cultural backgrounds and ideas and identities. And he's kind of a legend on something called Grind Time, which you can find on YouTube. And it's a battle where two freestylers will attempt to verbally shred each other to pieces. And it's really vicious, actually. It's funny. I mean, it's very funny. And so A-Class is a Grind Time legend for his ability to cut up his opponents.
I can use your own language better. Come to class and spark it. You'll get housed in English like a flat apartment.
Son, you look like Gary Busey very loosely.
This dude hates me for my skin color, but he thought racism was believing in NASCAR.
So they come into your lab. I assume this means you're hooking them up to your brain imaging machine?
Exactly. And so the first thing they do in the lab is actually outside the scanner where I have them memorize a few days in advance a rap that we had composed for them. And then we train them on what's going to happen in the scanner, which is that they have to keep their head still, which is not a trivial thing when you're talking about rapping.
Well, it's not just keeping your head still. I mean, I've been in fMRI machines, and I mean, it's really loud. You're crammed into a tiny claustrophobic space, and you have to remain absolutely still. I mean, this is not exactly the most conducive environment to be creative.
You're right. It's in some ways, it's the worst. It's like, look, you're going to be put into this very strange, dark tube where you're going to have headphones on. It's going to be very noisy in the background, but you'll be hearing through these insert earphones. And we're going to ask you to keep your head still and not to move your feet, not to tap your hands, nothing. Only use your mouth to the degree that you need to rap.
So what did they do once they were hooked up, once they sort of learned the drill? What steps did you take them through?
So I talked a lot with the rappers about how freestylers go about their business of, say, practicing. And it turns out that there's something called the word game that freestylers do, which is that there'll be a group of rappers. Usually one person will sort of set up a light beat in the background. One person will be the rapper, and one person will be feeding words to the rapper. So, you know, every four lines or so, a new word will be sort of shouted out. So, for example, you know, water might come out, and then the freestyler would work water into his next few lines.
Search.
And so we did the word game. So what we had the rappers do was first memorize this pre-composed rap that I told you about, and that was to serve as the control condition that we would be comparing freestyle rap to.
So the memorized rap versus the freestyle rap.
Exactly. So when the experiment proceeded, we had the rappers that would have a beat, and we would feed them words every four bars or so. They wouldn't know what's coming. They would have to work it into a rhyme.
Freestyle. Like.
I'm like some kind of weird alien, mixed with an extraterrestrial celestial sage. Back in the days, I used to sit in pyramids and meditate with two microphones.
Head.
Over my head, see if I could still listen, spitting off the top, and see what you get in.
First thing we found was that they're definitely able not only to hear the word and to work it in, but to rhyme it in a pretty clever way. And then the brain activity was pretty remarkable, I would say. What we found was that when a rapper is rapping normally, there's obvious engagement of language areas of the brain. And that's not surprising. I mean, you have to use language areas of the brain to rap. But when you start freestyling, your language areas get ramped up to a much higher degree than when you're just normally rapping. That sort of suggests that the creative version of rapping is the more brain-intensive or resource-demanding activity.
Now, you said that when these rappers sort of got into their freestyle mode, they got into the zone. I mean, there was some sense of flow. I mean, it almost sounds like you're saying that they were in an altered state of consciousness.
I think that's exactly right. In fact, if you watch a rapper, if you talk to a rapper, you'll see right away that that's what's happening. I mean, it's sort of a semi-conscious state where ideas are coming out of you very rapidly, very quickly. You're not in conscious direct control of what's coming out. And so it's sort of analogous to jazz musicians in a sense that they are improvising, maybe not consciously controlling every note that's coming out per se, yet obviously in charge of the music that they're generating.
I know you've done previous research with jazz musicians. I mean, you've had them come into your lab and play, which is a trick in itself to play a jazz instrument in an fMRI scanner. And you also asked them to improvise. So how do you compare the improvising jazz musician with the freestyling rapper?
It's been a really interesting comparison. We had two jazz musicians sort of trading back and forth in a kind of musical conversation. And in that experiment, we really found something kind of intriguing, which is that when jazz musicians have a musical conversation, not using any words at all, just using a piano, that language areas of the brain are highly active during that conversation. And so that suggests something about what a language area really means. And there's a bold suggestion that really maybe these areas of the brain that we think are for language are really for auditory communication taken a little more broadly. And then I think rap is kind of on the other extreme, where it's a musical form that is primarily language-based, yet we see that it employs elements of prefrontal cortex shutdown and also complex auditory processing.
What about rhyming? Because we know that that is central to a lot of rappers. And I guess I'm wondering, can you tell just by looking at the brain scan whether someone is rhyming?
I could not. I'll tell you this. There seems to be an auditory component to this idea of rhyming. And that's kind of an interesting idea when you think about the generation of a rhyme, that, you know, maybe you're not just thinking about the word. Maybe you're thinking about the sound of the word.
But that, I mean, it's fascinating to think about this because, I mean, language is really two things. It is about meaning. I mean, normally when we're talking, I mean, we're trying to convey information, but it's also just about sound. And I would think those might be two very different things.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, so one thing I didn't mention is that in the experiment where the two jazz musicians were sort of having this musical conversation back and forth, one area of the brain was shut down was an area of the brain called the angular gyrus. And this is a part of the brain that's linked to semantic cognition. So exactly what you just said, the meaning of words. In music, it's never clear what the meaning really is. And so when musicians were having this conversation musically, it was without the involvement of the part of the brain that's linked to interpreting meaning of words.
Now, it seems that you are working on a larger project here. I mean, all of these studies that you've been doing are really about the nature of creativity, the neuroscience of creativity. Are you at the point where you can start to draw some general conclusions about what's happening in the brain when we're doing something really creative?
You're right. That is my larger question. I really want to know how it is that we human beings can generate the ideas we generate. And to me, art may be the most fascinating example of our ability to do that, although it's certainly not the only one. And so I think we need to characterize these processes in many ways that remain to be done. For example, what's the difference between a genius brain and a non-genius brain in terms of creativity? What's the difference between a child's brain and an adult's brain, or an amateur's brain versus an expert's brain? We know that there's this creative capacity in humans, but maybe we're not harnessing it quite right. And once we understand how the brain is able to be creative, then we might be able to devise ways to manipulate our brains to be more creative than they are in ways that are safe, legal, controllable, and maybe it could enhance us to generate more novel ideas and more innovation than we do.
Charles Lim is a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins University. If you'd like to hear Steve's complete uncut interview, you'll find it on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the magic of high school theater and a conversation with legendary composer Stephen Sondheim. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you want a shot of inspiration, one place to find it is a great high school theater production, like the kind so many people love watching in Glee. Or if you want a real-life example, consider the theater program at Harry S. Truman High School in Levittown, Pennsylvania. It's not a famous city. It's not a well-known school. And yet, the billionaire producer of Cats, The Phantom of the Opera, and Miss Saigon attends its performances. Why? In his book Drama High, Michael Sokolov tells the story of this remarkable theater program and its legendary drama coach, Lou Volpe.
Lou Volpe is at heart, he's a teacher, and there's a lot of magic that goes on, you know, in that setting. What makes a teacher inspiring? And sometimes it's not what a teacher says that has to be that profound, but it's when they say it and where it goes to. So Lou Volpe had a way of just hitting a place in students that no teacher and no parent had ever hit before, and knowing something inside of that student that the student didn't know himself or herself. And he has transported this from his classroom into this incredible theater program.
And we should say he's been there at Truman High for a long time, decades now, director of drama. Was it obvious from the beginning that this was going to work for him?
Well, that's a hard question. I mean, I think things are not ever really obvious from the beginning, although I will say that he was my teacher. I am now 57 years old. So Lou Volpe was my teacher when I was 16 years old, and he was in his mid-20s. And all of a sudden, I came to his classroom, and one day he said to me, you know, by the way, you're a really good writer. And that was really life-changing. It's like, wow, I'm a good writer? Well, maybe I ought to try this stuff out. Maybe I ought to take myself seriously in this regard. And I think it was life-changing.
Well, that leads directly into, it seems to me, what the essence of his work in the theater is, whether it's a play or a musical. One of the things that impressed me when I was reading the story is the interviews you did with people who remembered being maybe a star in the sophomore production and expected to go on to be the star in subsequent productions, but by senior year were willing maybe not even to appear on stage.
Well, it's a competitive program. I think that at any high school, if the basketball team is a perennial state champion, well, when you come to try out for that basketball team, you better have game. And you also better be able to keep your watch out for somebody younger coming along. So people knew they had to have game. You know, his young actors and actresses knew, you know, somebody's always on my heels. There's some young blood behind me. You got what you earned.
One of the things that I think everybody, when they see the title Drama High, almost immediately thinks of these days is the TV program Glee, which has put such a spotlight on high school drama and music. Did that change the way Lou Volpe was seen by the Levittown community at all, do you think?
I think that it may have changed it some because, you know, Glee is very much part of our culture and a very successful show and a very good show. One of the funny things about Glee is that it celebrates that a male athlete might want to be in a show. And what makes me chuckle about that is that Lou has been doing that for 25 years now. And it's one of the great reasons for his success, because he made this program something that every self-limiting, self-identifying clique wanted to be a part of. You know, he is success. And therefore, you know, he drew all these male athletes into his theater, and some of them gave up football, some of them gave up sports, you know, to be in the theater.
We should point out, too, that he's not doing simple things in his theater program. One of the things he's best known for was doing the first high school performance of the musical Rent,
which has very challenging themes, more so back in 2007 than perhaps now. 2007 is when he did it. But I will say, most high schools still will not touch it.
Well, of course, it has HIV and AIDS in it. It has a drug culture in it. That's not something a lot of communities want on stage.
That's absolutely right. You know, it's just too hot to handle. And 300 students out of the 1,500 students at that school auditioned for parts in Rent. The auditions went on all day, and then they went on another day all day. And when they put on the show, Jonathan Larson, who was the playwright, who passed away not long before the show made its debut, Jonathan Larson's father came to Levittown, sat on the uncomfortable wood plank seats in the ancient auditorium, and went on stage afterward to talk about Truman Theater. So this was a huge event when they did Rent.
It's not just about theater, though, is it? This is at root more about... About what? About learning to be on task?
I think it's about learning to find your humanity, finding your confidence, finding that you are a person who has some mission in life. You know, these are qualities that transcend theater. There's a great actor from his recent years who I met when I was there who wants to become a police officer. I can't think of any better training to become a police officer than learning empathy and poise and direction in a theater program like this.
We're talking about high school students. We're talking about 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids. But Volpe's demanding a kind of professionalism from them. He wants them to read the plays. He wants them to talk about the authors. He wants to go into who the characters are. He's really talking about life, isn't he?
He's absolutely talking about life, and he's doing it at as intense a level as his students can handle, and then beyond. One of his students said to me about the challenging material that they do. He said, "We do the kind of theater that makes people feel uncomfortable in life, things that they don't want to talk about. But that's why you do theater, right?
We're talking about Levittown here, and I don't mean to be disparaging of Levittown, but its days of enormous success were not in the last decade.
No, they weren't in the last decade, and they weren't in the decade before that either. I grew up in Levittown in the early 70s when U.S. Steel's Fairless Works plant employed 10,000 people, and they made very, very good salaries. This was the heyday of you know, muscular America. Levittown now is ground zero for income equality, the death of unions. You know, it's a hurting place. I think one of the things about Truman Drama and Lou Volpe is he's giving them sort of counter-programming to their lives in a way that's entirely unrelated to money and status. You know, one of the things that he says to them is, if all we had was a bare light bulb and a stage, we could still do theater. And they look at him and they believe that. And I think they feel that if he said, that's what we're doing this year, they say, okay, we'll do that and we'll take it to the Thespian Festival and we'll win awards. I mean, they believe so deeply in the power of this art that he gives them.
Michael Sokolov's book about Lou Volpe and Truman High School is called Drama High.
How do you say to your child in the night, nothing's all black, but then nothing's all white? How do you say it will all be all right when you know that it mightn't be true? What do you do?
Stephen Sondheim is the reigning genius of musical theater. His credits include some of the greatest Broadway shows of the last 60 years, from West Side Story and Gypsy to Sweeney Todd and Sunday in the Park with George. So if you wanted a masterclass in how to write both music and lyrics, well, we figured Sondheim would be the guy you'd want to hear from. So Steve Paulson had a few questions for Mr. Sondheim.
You started out as a lyricist, writing the songs for West Side Story and Gypsy, but for decades you've been both composer and lyricist, which is somewhat unusual when you look back at the great
musicals. Well,
not
really, because I did start out as a composer and lyricist. It's just my first job was just writing lyrics, and that was because I needed a job. And when I was lucky enough to be offered West Side Story, I didn't leap at it. I didn't want to do it. It was Oscar Hammerstein, who was my mentor, who said, no, you should do this. I know you want to write music, but you should do this because you'll be working with first-rate artists like Leonard Bernstein and Arthur Lawrence and Jerome Robbins.
Why didn't you want to do that at first?
Oh, because lyric writing is not anywhere near as much fun or even as satisfying as writing music. You know, I find it very difficult to write lyrics, and I do a great deal of sweating, and they don't often come out as well as I would like them to. There's so many restrictions, both in terms of language and the way words fit with music, that the chances of writing a really good lyric are, I won't say slim, but they're not great. You really have to keep at it. It's an awful lot of sweat work. Since I have two choices, I would much rather, it's much more fun to write music.
So when you're working on a new piece of work, do you start with the words and then layer the music on top, or do they come kind of simultaneously?
That's simultaneously. Usually, having discussed for weeks with the librettist what's going to happen and how songs will function in a show, and then the librettist starts to write the libretto so I can have a style to follow and to imitate.
Bit by bit, putting it together. Piece by piece, only way to make a work of art. Every moment makes a contribution. Every little detail plays a part. Having just the vision's no solution. Everything depends on execution. Putting it together, that's what counts.
And since you've spot where you want the songs to go, at least to begin with, the first few songs, it's useful to come up with a refrain line or a line that sums up what any given song is about. And if you can think of that idea, sometimes that will suggest a tune, because I believe in tunes coming out of the inflection of language.
Everybody says don't.
Everybody says don't.
Everybody says don't. Everybody says
don't.
It isn't right.
Don't. It isn't not.
I write conversational lyrics. So if I write a lyric that expresses finishing the hat, da-da-da-da-dum, right away there's a rhythm there, finishing the hat. And maybe if I said it that way, the melody would go up. But finishing the hat is the way I would say it. So melody goes up and then drops a little bit. So Often a lyric idea will suggest a tune.
What you feel like climbing the sky, what you feel when voices that come through the window go until they distance and die.
Now, you dispense various pieces of wisdom about how to write lyrics. One is less is more. And I'm wondering if you've always known that, or was that something you had to learn over time?
Oh, no, that's something I learned over time. You know, all beginning writers are verbose when they start. There are too many words and too many notes. I remember Oscar once, he was talking about his collaboration with Jerome Kern, and I can't remember exactly how he put it in my head, but what it amounted to was, see if you can write a melody composed of whole notes. He didn't actually say that, but meaning very few notes, it is very easy to tire the ear. Not only are you being sung at, but there's stuff going on the stage. There are many things to concentrate on, everything from the lighting to the scene. You have to give a lyric air, and it has to. You have to make your points as concisely and swiftly as possible. Unless, of course, if you're writing for a garrulous character, like I pointed this out, you know, in the chapter on Sweeney Todd and Finishing the Hat, that, you know, Mrs. Lovett is a garrulous woman. So her first song is very verbose, but that's because of who she is.
Did you come here for a pie, sir? Do forgive me if me head's a little fake. Ugh, what is that? But you think we are the plague? From the way that people keep affording, no, you don't. Heaven knows I try, sir.
So when you look back on some of your early lyrics, do you think you overdid it at times?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, I didn't overdo it in West Side Story because those are not verbose characters, but it's very heavily overly poetic with a capital P, because that's what Leonard Bernstein wanted me to do, and I was 25 years old, and I did what I was told to a certain. And by the time we got through writing it, when I was 27, I was a little more my own master, and so the last few songs I wrote, I think, are much better. After that, I learned that I didn't have to do what I was told anymore.
So, as a lyricist, are you basically writing poetry?
No, I think of it as light verse, if it has to be labeled. The whole idea of poetry is the compactness and the suggested resonance of ideas and images and that sort of thing. And if you put music to it, it just, as they say in England, over eggs the pudding. It's all too rich. Music is so rich in and of itself, you have to underwrite lyrics, I think, which is why most lyrics do not read particularly well on the page. My favorite example being the one I opened the first book with, which is, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, Oh, What a Beautiful Day. When you look at the lyric of Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, it's really not very interesting, and it's rather flat, and it has very little resonance to it. But when you hear it with the music that it was meant to accompany, it soars, and it's very rich and full of feeling and atmosphere and exactly what it should. You know, there are foxes and hedgehogs. There are certain writers who sort of stick to one plot of land and dig deep into it, somebody like Tennessee Williams. But there are certain writers, I like to contrast him with Paddy Chayefsky, who virtually never repeated himself, who wrote every conceivable kind of play.
Are you saying you are the fox here?
Yeah, I consider myself a fox here. I really try not to repeat myself because I don't want to bore myself, and I also don't want to be too comfortable with what I'm writing. And, you know, somebody once said that the only kind of writing one should do is the kind that frightens one. That is to say, if you're going to start on something, it better damned well scare you. Because if it doesn't, you're likely to be just rewriting what you wrote before, which was, I must say, very easy to do, both musically and lyrically and in terms of the piece itself. I was smart enough to know, because after Gypsy, I got numbers of requests to do backstage or showbiz musicals, and I knew enough to say no to every single one of them.
Let me entertain you. Let me.
Now, I think it's pretty clear that this kind of musical theater that you've been describing, this highly literate theater for adults, has largely vanished. I mean, Broadway musicals are something quite different now. Family entertainment, you know, kind of Disney spectacles you take your kids to. And I assume you find all this rather depressing. But the question is why? What is it about our culture that no longer appreciates sort of the wit and sophistication of great musical theater?
Well, you're just talking about musical theater. It's what is widely referred to as the dumbing down of America.
Silly people, silly people.
What you're describing is also something that takes place in movies and all forms of entertainment. Everything is getting down to primary colors and immediacy. But there are musicals being written that have the values you're referring to, and there are certainly movies that are being made. They're just not the big blockbuster movies, and they're not the big blockbuster musicals.
Gods of the theater, smile on us. You who sit up there stern in judgment, smile on us.
Now, I have to say, one of the most delicious parts of reading Look, I Made a Hat was your take on critics, which I'm guessing was kind of fun for you to write. And one of the things you say is it takes a long time to learn not to pay attention to critics, or at least not to let them distract you. I take it you do read all your reviews.
No, I don't. I read the New York Times, because that's the one, and even that doesn't affect ticket sales the way it used to. And that's the only one that really interests me. Occasionally I'll read a review if somebody sends me one that he or she thinks is interesting. But no, I don't see any point in reading the reviews. Here in New York, I know how a show is received. I don't have to read the reviews.
So what is it you don't like about critics?
Oh, it's not what I don't like. It has nothing to do with that. I just make the point. There's a difference between a critic and a reviewer. A reviewer is a journalist who has to assess something on one seeing and one hearing. And for something as complex as a serious play or a musical that has any what you would call subtlety to it, that's a very difficult call to make, to write about something and assess it on one viewing. So their value is nil, except as publicists. And that's why critics are necessary, because they publicize a show. Mm-hmm. By merely writing the review, it makes the public aware that this show has opened. And if it sounds like it'd be fun to see, then it sells tickets.
The art of making art is putting it together, bit by bit.
We really need all...
Stephen Sondheim, talking with Steve Paulson. If you want to hear Steve's extended, unedited interview with Sondheim, you'll find it on our website at ttbook.org. And if you'd like to read Sondheim's lyrics, you might want to check out his two books, Finishing the Hat and Look, I Made a Hat. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking this hour about words and music, which led us straight to the Grammy Award-winning composer Maria Schneider after years of writing instrumental music. Her most recent album sets a series of poems to music. It's called Winter Morning Walks. Now, Schneider's music is hard to categorize. It straddles the worlds of jazz and classical music. And Strange Champs was curious about the backstory behind her latest project.
Maria, I want to talk about the genesis of this new album, Winter Morning Walks, which is kind of a three-way collaboration between you and soprano Dawn Upshaw and some texts by poet laureate Ted Kooser and also by the great Brazilian poet Carlos Drummond de Andrade. How did this come about?
Well, I had been on the road in Europe with my band, and a person in my band, Ingrid Jensen, a wonderful trumpet player, she had a podcast. And there was a poet on it that I fell in love with. His poetry felt like home. For instance, you know, the poem about walking by flashlight at 6 in the morning. Yeah, it's so beautiful, you know. And suddenly this flashlight, who would think a flashlight could all of a sudden become so poetic, and seeing the circle of light as the moon on a leash.
My circle of light on the gravel, swinging side to side.
I don't know what it is. That poem always makes me feel like I want to cry. And it's not a sad thing. I don't know why it makes me want to cry. It's so sweet.
Well, he wrote most of these as he was recovering from treatment for cancer, so there must have been a lot of sadness, a certain amount of grief went into these.
Yeah, and I think also a deep, I think he wrote that poetry as he felt himself kind of coming back into the world, you know, and slowly recovering, somehow feeling like he wanted to write again. And I think there probably was just this huge sense of gratification for life.
So what did you do when you sat down to set these texts to music?
I don't know. This was probably the easiest music for me to write ever because I love the poems so much. You know, walking by flashlight, I thought, I want something that just, you know, in the chords and the piano, just feels like it's walking, you know, and just the straight beat. And that piece, it came out so easy. Like it wrote itself. It was like a pop tune or something.
Talk with you about beauty. Your music is so often really lyrically beautiful in a way that feels unusual, maybe sometimes even slightly risky. I mean, I guess I'm thinking that after modernism, you know, beauty became kind of a suspect quality in art.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even an obsolete quality. So I'm wondering where you find the beauty in music, and do you ever worry that you're writing something that's too beautiful?
Oh, it's an interesting question because, you know, when I was in college at the University of Minnesota, at that time in the classical world, beauty was this suspect thing. And I really kind of ditched the classical world because there was no room for that. Mm-hmm. And I found that the jazz world was so open-minded. And then I went to Brazil and I discovered a culture where music is the center of life. It's like sustenance, and it's full of joy, and it's full of unabashed beauty. You know, there's a thing about writing beauty. Maybe it's like Ted's poetry. You know, you can write something that's accessible and beautiful, but it feels like fluff. It feels vacant. It doesn't feel smart.
It's like
and
sugar without anything
yeah,
more.
Yeah, without substance. And then there's a certain kind of beauty that grabs you and has a complexity underneath.
Where do you go to find that ravishing beauty?
I feel it. You know, I feel it in my bones. It's like, I think that's the mystery in art.
Well, it's interesting that you said you feel it in your bones physically. And I was thinking some of the most beautiful and even uplifting music, I'm thinking in particular about your Grammy-winning CD, Concert in the Garden. Some of that you composed during a really difficult time, shortly after you'd been diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm curious, did the experience of dealing with cancer and a changed relationship with your body affect the way you wrote music?
Yeah, so I get so scared to start something new. It's like facing the unknown is just horrible. And I had this big commission for Jazz at Lincoln Center, and I was scared, and then all of a sudden this thing came up. I, you know, I was supposed to be working on this music, and suddenly I had breast cancer, and a very dear friend of mine was dying of it. And I was such a mess, and I said, okay, I'm going to call the Wynton Marsalis people tomorrow and just tell them I'm pulling out. I can't do this. They'll understand. And I was sitting there and I was so full of fear. And the only way that I could calm myself down was I went over to the piano, going to the music purely as an escape for myself. And suddenly, all of a sudden, I was writing down music, and I felt like I was, before I was bouncing on these horrible waves of the ocean, but all of a sudden I was in my own world making beautiful sound, and it felt like a submarine going underneath, and the storm was above me, and I could see it and think about it, but it wasn't shaking me. And I think it's probably the most powerful piece I ever wrote.
Such a wonderful ear for finding the sounds that connect with what soars inside us. And you know, so maybe it's not surprising I read that you also have a huge passion for birds.
Yes, that's just the most fun thing in my life. I love it.
Have you ever used any actual bird song in a piece?
I have, yeah. There's a piece called Cerulean Skies on my Sky Blue album, and I put in the real call from the Macaulay Library at Cornell of the Cerulean Warbler, which is it's not on the endangered list, but it probably should be or will be soon.
Have you ever actually seen one?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in Central Park, some guy said, hey, there's a cerulean over at 87th Street. And I said, what? And sure enough, there were these little oak trees along the street and all these birders lined up. And for a whole day, from morning until evening, this cerulean warbler was flitting from, you know, tree to tree, very low. And I went back at 7 in the evening. There were no more birders, but the bird was still there. And a cop drove by and he said, is this where the famous bird is? And I'm like, yep, that blue bird up there. And it was amazing, you know. So I thought it was the cerulean coming to personally thank me for writing Cerulean Skies. That was my interpretation.
Oh, wow. Well, on behalf of all your fans, thank you for the such beautiful music you've given all of us.
Oh, thank you.
Jazz composer Maria Schneider talking with Ann Strainchamps. Her album, Winter Morning Walks, features Ted Kooser's poetry sung by Dawn Upshaw. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to find out what music we played or the books we talked about, well, you'll find all of that and much more on our website at ttbook.org. You can follow us on our Facebook page or on Twitter. The handle's at ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Special theme music from Joe Hartke. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.